looking for management.
Good morning, Mark Spears, CEO. Good morning, Mr. Spears, legal services.
Can you do this? Can you do the office assurance? I'm Jamie Carpo, he's in the 14. And I'm with.
Morning, just on the line, see if I.
Good morning, Edison, for the Easter, Provincial Community Services.
Good morning, Maria Carapone.
Good morning, Park Spain, Corporate Communication.
Good morning, Jose Tarelano, International Relations and Priority Programs.
Good morning, Gabriel Alexander, CEO.
Renitra Financial Management, Department of the Premium.
Thank you very much. Before we start, I'm asked to inform you that there is no water provided. But in the event that you would like some water, the water cooler outside the chamber to the right. Premier, I'm going to answer to you for introductory remarks and then. Thank you. Then from then to the law, before we go page by page, if there are any questions that you would like to put on the premium that you want.
To the indicative baseline.
year. Because for the previous year, because we haven't actually looked at that amount of the previous year, so just trying to understand how the issue of the 4% actually works out. If you look at the overall budget for this year, which is page 25. So on page 25 of the estimate, there's reference there to 1.486, which is the amount this year, and you would look at the revised estimate after the main appropriation last year was 1,440 million, okay, and then even with the after the estimate dropped slightly to 1.398. If you look at this year, that's 1,486 million, which is almost 100 million more than last year. So when the Premier talks about the 4%, can she or the CFO just take us through that? Because there's reference being made to a mandatory budget cut of 200, and I think you indicated that in this first year of the MTF, you mentioned a particular amount, but could you just explain how you get to the 4%, given that if you look on page 25 and you actually compare what we got last year for this department to what we're getting this year, it's basically an amount of almost 100 million more directly. So could you just explain exactly how you get to the 4%?
So just to note that we're talking about the increase of the budget that was published last year in the middle year of that budget period. So in January last year, we had a budget presentation, no budget. Then we had the two other years, and at the time, we had 1.545 billion planned in that budget. That's the MTF budget. If you compare the 1.486 to that, you will find it's 3.8% less. So in other words, that baseline that we were indicated would be our budget, and which we planned for, was then reduced by 3.8%. But closer to this, if I can refer the honourable member to page 38, if you go to table 8.4, then you look at subprogram 4, it's called Connected Government and Unified Communications. That is where our broadband goes, the broadband project. You will see the revised estimate, 236 million. The 1819 amount is 120 million more for broadband. Right? So if you talk about discretionary budget, we say there is a project that is funded by Treasury in our books. That increase of 120 you have to play off against the budgets that you have for the year. Because that is money that is spoken for. It's labeled money. We have no power over initial from it. It's actually earmarked allocation. So if you take off your project funding, then you will find that you are closer to the number that we are talking about. So in other words, we say, although broadband has its own trajectory, in terms of our departmental capability, we have to cut by 2.8%.
And Jacob, at this point, so do you know my microphone? So actually, if you look at the figure that I quoted, I mean, what's before us, I know that you're making reference to an indicative baseline, but if you actually look at what's in front of us, this department has got an additional increased budget.
Now, Chair, that's why the Premier's forward says on the indicative baseline of 1819 there was a reduction. It doesn't say that compared to the previous year there's a reduction. What I put in addition is that we have to reduce those amounts for the project amount. Project money is earmarked money. We don't have discretion over that. you take out the profit, you'll find that the capital share amount of the budget is much less. It's simply not a good opportunity. So, of any budget, how it is put together. The profit comes up here, to just spend that on the profit itself. The balance is then much less than what we have to do.
Just a final question, but if you would like to do a calculation, and possibly I'm sure that the CFO would do this quicker than we would, if you had to compare the 1398 that we got last year, which was revised, to 1.486, in terms as reflecting this budget, what percentage increase would that be?
Chair, that is on page 25, it's 6.3. It's just next to it.
But actually, on the issue in front of us, if we don't consider the negative side, we have 6.3% increase.
Chair, if we don't consider the project, which is broken.
Members, are there any further questions on the fairness board?
Chair, I could just ask, in the premier's written forward, and I'm sure you won't mind, Chair, but also refer to that. In the third last paragraph, there's reference, the Premier makes reference to the fact that this year we'll see the commencement of the crafting of a new provincial strategic plan with an advance of terming the new government in order to ensure greater alignment. Could the Premier just give us a sense of what is the actual process that will be involved in drafting this new provincial strategic plan? How far are you at the moment? What is the process involved? Who is engaged? Who is consulted? I'm not raising this issue of the fact that it's important to draft such a plan, but could you just give a sense, particularly in regard to how, what level of consultation would happen in developing this plan? Is it just an internal consultation in the department? Does it involve other provincial departments? Does it involve local government? Does it involve community? The actual process of getting to the new provincial strategic plan.
It's not appropriate for an upper government to draft a full strategic plan for incoming government. What is appropriate is to assess where you have got on your own strategic plan for the term of office. And we have a very clear strategic plan, a strategic goal, backed up by action plan with measurable outcomes. And I would imagine that any incoming government would not like to simply start on a clean slate, but would like to take into account what has been done and what has been achieved and what has not been achieved in the previous term and analyse why on all of the aspects that I've mentioned. So what we are doing and have done, as you heard the start of it in the State of the Province address, was evaluating very carefully against what our objectives are and were, where we are, and where we have made more progress than we anticipated, and where we have made less progress than we anticipated, and why. So there's a very, very clear platform for a new government to continue. I hope it's safe to say that for a new government, the priority will continue to be economic growth and jobs, and to fulfill the mandate that the province has in terms of the constitution, which is in two primary areas of delivery, or three. The two primary ones are education and health, and then also the oversight mechanisms that we have in other areas. And so there is an enormous amount to learn of where we have been and how continuity can proceed without in any way shackling a new government from preparing its own plan for its term of office. So there are legislative requirements around planning and around embedding a new term plan, strategic term plan for any government, and the new government will certainly undergo that particular process. What I want to do is make sure we leave a very coherent analysis of what we try to do, what we achieved in doing, what we consider to be worthwhile following, which
doesn't necessarily bind the government, but gives a strong indication of the direction that we think would be worth pursuing, and then hand over a well-functioning ship with a clear direction that is heading firmly in what we believe to be the right direction, but which does not stop the new government from using statutory processes to steer in a different direction.
Words here in this report say we will commence with the crafting of a new financial strategic plan well in advance. So what does that actually mean? When will a draft of this plan be available? Will the plan be finished? Will it be draft form in a standard? I think we just want clarity that I think this committee would obviously like to be involved and will be briefed about the process of drafting this new provincial strategic plan. Because the Premier is referring to assessments of what works and what doesn't work. But this specific decision
I could have done one thing differently. It would have been to be much more skeptical of South African weather service forecasting for the winter of 2017. What happened was the briefings that the government got over the likelihood of the drought continuing and the documentation we received and the presentations that were given, not directly to me, but to my colleagues, showed us that we were in for a record rainfall year last year. I did not hear any caveat produced on that. The notion that we would have a very heavy rainfall year was the bottom line of what our career service. Now, we can only rely on the statistics that we get from specialist agencies around where the problems are. And although we've had 2 years of drought, the calculation was that it was highly unlikely to have another year of drought. And the prediction and the projection by the South African Weather Service was that the drought would be broken. If I could do one thing over, I would have been more skeptical about that. What I did not know at the time was that the prediction around the weather had been so fundamentally distorted by the impact of climate change. And that is something that I only really learned about later on, and it was only something that South African Weather Service informed us about this year. So when they did the briefing to us this year, they picked us. Our predictions last year were completely wrong. And we're not there with the prediction this year. So we are effectively now flying blind. If I had known last year that we were flying blind, things might have looked a little different from our risk management point of view. But having said that, I feel pretty confident, and having been involved every step of the way, that given our mandate, we have to pull that mandate and have to scrutinize it in the two sides. So, for example, our first dry year was 2015. Our first dry year was in 2014, our dams were still overflowing. 2015 was our first dry year. And at the end of that year, the risk assessment colleagues and other colleagues said, if we have another dry winter, we're going to be in trouble. So we applied in November 2015 for the entire province to be declared a disaster area. Now you understand that our powers only kick in when there is a declared disaster. We have no other power. And risk assessment said that if we have another dry winter, we're in trouble. So we had to ask for disaster management powers to be able to actually do something, not just foresee something. And so we applied, and the National Disaster Management Center said no. The dams are not low enough, and they were still 75% full at that stage. So I can understand the theoretical argument that you don't declare a provincial disaster when your dams are 75% full. But we asked for that disaster because you were concerned about the possibility, and it was only a vague possibility at that stage, of another dry winter. In January 2016, we managed to get an agreement from the National Disaster Management Center, and then an agreement from the National Minister of COXA at the time, to declare, I think, the 6 areas in the province, local disasters. And on every one of those, the interventions that we made to support and help them meet that disaster have been successful, and are all but one, which is Canada, is water secure. So I'm happy that that was predicted, that that was foreseen, and that our support to our own department of local government really helped support and get those municipalities through the crisis. Then we did have another crisis in 2016. And then we were in real trouble. And we applied again for the entire province to be declared a disaster, and that was refused. You will remember that as late as March 2017, Mr. Rashid Khan of the National Department of Water and Sanitation here in the Western Cape said that he was just trying to manipulate the drought to get extra support from the national government, or words to that effect. and I remember having a big go at him here in this chamber around the crisis and around the fact the national government and the Department of Water and Sanitation in particular was not prepared to recognize the extent of the crisis. Well, he didn't know that Thomas's department was totally bankrupt and could not actually fulfill its national mandate of water augmentation and major bulk supply. So I'm satisfied when I toothcomb the entire history of this particular disaster, that we spotted it in time, that we took preemptive action in time within our mandate, which is merely disaster management. So all we could do was to spot the disaster coming, which we did, seek disaster powers, which we did, and use those disaster powers in the very limited cases where we were granted the power to do so, which we did. National departments at every level, including the EK Weather Service, let us down either because they refused to declare disasters or because they mismanaged their funds so badly that they were bankrupt and could do nothing about it, or because they got predictions wrong. And that says that some journalists keep reporting that I'm blaming the South African Weather Service for the drought. I'm obviously not doing it. I understand that it's very difficult in an era of climate change to make accurate predictions. And I've read a lot about it now to find that this is a problem all over the world. What I would have liked to know at the beginning of the 2017 winter was that it was indeed difficult to project and to predict, and that the projections may well be wrong, which is something that I did not know at the beginning of 2017. So the bottom line is that if I go through every step of what we were supposed to do, we did those things. Because obviously I asked myself, could we have perceived this in a better way? Could we have done anything different within our mandate and within our power? And I have to say that I'm extraordinarily grateful to many of my colleagues who, without my even knowing it, took preemptive steps at critical moments in line with our mandate. So I would like to thank them very much, because I really can't think of within provincial government's powers of water and oversight and disaster management
that you could have anything other than people. Thank you, Premier. Colleagues, we will now proceed to close the mic.
Thank you.
problem with the Premier coordinating external communication. And I think the reality, if we're honest, and I'm sure the Premier will give us an honest answer, this was a very unprecedented way of communicating. The Premier is the first citizen of this province. There's a mayor. And then suddenly we had this. So I think the question does relate to the main service of this department, not only as Mr. Morgan has said about communication and coordinating certain communication, but also embedding good governance. We've had a situation where the leader of a political party has been talking on behalf of the province, which is quite extraordinary actually. So it would be interesting to hear a very direct response from the Premier. I don't think she can be too happy about what's happening.
Thank you very much, Chair. We are a developing democracy and our system of intergovernmental mandates and frameworks is complicated. And many people don't understand. So in water and in every sphere of government, there are certain responsibilities that vest in the national government, certain responsibilities that vest in the provincial government, and certain responsibilities that vest in local government. And because local government is responsible for water reticulation and purification and delivering water to the end user, many people quite erroneously think that water is a local government function. In fact, the local government can only and reticulate water to the end user if it is there in the dam in the first place. And bulk water supply is a national government competency, and provinces come into this in terms of oversight and in terms of disaster management, as I have already explained. Now, inevitably, when a disaster strikes, and I gave the chronology of that disaster in broad outline in answer to a previous question, when a disaster strikes, the first thing that many people do is to try to lay blame. And political parties and others were quick to lay blame quite erroneously on the Premier's case. Because they step up to the plate, because the national government would not declare a disaster and has failed fundamentally in both supply and implementation, to step in to do the job that it should have been national government's duty. And because they were actually bailing the national government out, ironically, and as often happens, they turned out to be the target of criticism. And then it wasn't long before that criticism morphed into a criticism of the governing party in Cape Town and the Western Cape. Now that obviously has a major impact on party politics. And it was used as an election tool for all our opposition was worth. And in that context, the leader of the political party had to come into the context and say, are we doing our jobs properly? And he asked us, and he required us, quite appropriately, as others have done here, to come to him for the kind of jobs we were doing. And quite correctly and quite appropriately, I had to go along and show everything we had done in terms of our mandate and what we were supposed to do to satisfy the leader that this government should function appropriately in the name of the political party in which he was elected. He took over no operational functions. He took over no instructional functions. He was merely saying, I want to know what you're doing, and then he took responsibility for coordinating communication and putting it out in a holistic and transversal way. So I don't believe that he interfered in his government or took over our functions. And as you know, I continue communicating all the time. And the first of communication was the weekly updates that I would give on water and what was going on with water, and the broad sphere in terms of DA governance was given by the leader of the DA.
Thank you very much. Members, we move on to page 2. Member
Kimmerer. Thank you, Chair. Thanks to the Premier. On page 2, I think it's a fourth paragraph. The emphasis on very strongly on socio-economic development and sustainable growth. Now we all know that the Western Cape government is putting that as a priority. ecological crisis, flooding, etc., etc. Now we're at the lonely crisis as well. I just wanted to know, in terms of a new way of looking at things, in terms of forging linkages, engagements, partnering with people, because it's all about, we tend to think water, but then we tend to think the tangible issues. But there are non-tangible issues like people's psyche, they are hysteria, people who seem doom and gloom, who are scared and uncertain. And I think an informed electorate is so important, sensitized electorate, and I'm glad there's a communication strategy in place that's been devised. I just want to know from previous whether that you adapt your strategy in terms of these things, these engagements, whether it is being broadened, or whether new and other players are being drawn in terms of this, because it asks for a new paradigm shift. Because we're working, we operate now in an entirely different environment, and whether it's based on any evidence in terms of forward planning. Thank you.
Back to using upward of 800
million litres of water a day, which was absolutely routine previously, we will get daily downstreams. And if there is no rain, we will be in very serious trouble this year. But what we are saying is that if the pattern unfolds as we think and hope, and I heard second hand, but I have to discount this information, that we are in for a wet winter. And I heard second hand that is what the South African Weather Service will now say, then we should be in the clear. But the message about the idea of not happening this year is not anything that should lead to complacency, otherwise we are at great risk again. But what we have to do is ensure the world knows what we are doing to establish water resilience, and this has been quite extraordinary. The growth of the water economy and the extent of savings that have been achieved by the city of Cape Town, as far as I know, in all my reading, I haven't come across another city that has managed to save such a high percentage of its water. And it's time that the message of resilience goes out there and the fact that we're capable of adapting to this crisis. So different messages are necessary at different times when there are different imperatives. But our highest imperative was and remains avoiding the zero. And the link between innovation and e-learning is very profound. E-learning is in itself a very strong innovation, and it requires the services of the Center for E-Innovation, that is a broadband, WAN and LAN platform, to be able to do this. I really don't know who. I know that Neotel and now Liquid Telecom have got the contract for the provision and the rollout of the broadband. That I know. I know that the lands are being provided by another company, which I don't know the name of. And I know that there are many, many e-learning packages out there and being tried and tested and used, and many on our e-portal.
In regard to the Premier's further comments about the water issue, I just wanted to ask, and hopefully the Premier won't have a problem trying to respond to it, but I'm sure that the Premier is aware that recent research has indicated that as much as 36 million litres of sewerage effluent is pumped out by the city every day. You talked about avoiding day zero, and I'm sure you're aware that there are many other cities that are in inland cities that basically process the effluent and utilize the water that is saved through that. Can I ask, this is another issue, and I think you're very much aware about from our side how we've been pushing for the appointment of the environmental commissioner, and we will raise that issue later on in this budget discussion. But is that something that your risk management people have ever raised with you since your appointment as a Premier? What is your view on this matter? Do you not think that there is not only an opportunity to save water, as some other cities appear to be doing, and also reduce the impact of pumping the sewage into the sea and what that impacts on marine life? Has this ever been a concern to you, or are you just simply not aware of it?
I'm very much aware. Thank you very much. I'm very much aware of this, and in our oversight we have established that there is a second network of pipes under the city of Cape Town, which takes partly treated effluent and can use it for non-potable purposes. Now that is a really important issue, because I think as we go further, we are going to have to get to a point where we distinguish between the use of potable and non-potable water. We don't have to even recycle effluent to the point of drinkability in order to be able to use it. And so, for example, we're looking at sewage systems to schools, which will rely on treated effluent that isn't of a potable standard, but is able to use to flush toilets, for example, and irrigate fields. And I'm very interested in the state's work of partly treated effluent in order to enable us to recycle water again and again and again in an affordable way and manage the potable resources that we have to maximum capacity. Because I mean, the days are gone when we can flush toilets and irrigate fields and wash motor cars with drinking water. So that is very, very much at the forefront, and I was unaware until the crisis hit us quite how much non-potable water is already used, and that there's a whole network of pipes into which people can tap in order to use this partly treated effluent. Now, in the city's plans, which we've also been overseeing very closely, they have a plan that by 2020 we will be augmenting by 300 million litres a day. The plan at this stage is that 150 million litres a day will come from desalination. And 150 will come from either recycling effluent or aquifer extraction. And that is considered at this stage of the information that we have, the appropriate mix that is affordable, that will still require us to look after water very, very carefully, and that will enable, if we have decent rain, to allow the desalination to be used for managed aquifer recharge. So all of those issues are absolutely critical, and I do believe that I think it's essential that we move more and more into treating effluent, even if not to the point of potability, to the point of being able to use it for many other water uses.
Thank you. Then as we move on to page 3. Page 4. Page 5. And
just a question. What is the relationship between this center for the innovation with the e-learning?
Technical e-innovation is a service department, like most of the departments in the previous departments. And so you can't have e-learning unless there is a broadband platform, a stable, reliable broadband platform. And the technical e-innovation, as I understand it, is to provide that platform. But maybe Mr. Assault is the answer to that. Maybe you realize it. Wasn't it all
thank you very much. Just to clarify, UNESCO, the CDI, provides primarily technical support to the Western Cape Education Department relating to e-learning. So our primary responsibilities would be around connectivity. The premier referred to the broadband network that we built up for the schools. In addition to that, other technical support, so as we learn applications, content delivery platforms and the like. So we completely align with the Western Cape Education Department and support them in achieving their objectives of e-learning.
Thank you. Just going to remember ask this question. Also on page 5, the second paragraph on the top. There's reference to the installation of base and end user computers, which includes PCs and tablets, and that the number has grown from 14,000 in 2009 to 24,000 last year. Could you just have a sense, if either you can have the answer now or later, of that number, how many tablets have actually been delivered to schools? Because obviously part of what we need to be looking at is, besides the so-called e-classrooms, to what extent are we actually using tablets in schools for individual learners? So I just want to get a sense of that number. And then also to ask what exactly is the support infrastructure which exists for a school that runs into a problem, either with the lab or the lab or whatever. Is the support for the schools located under CDI? And if so, what is the how is that support actually structured? What is the personnel numbers who's available? Can people go out and call? Because I know that remains a complaint from some schools, the issue of responsiveness. Is that CDI, have you taken that over completely now, or is that the best time to go in the CEP?
Thank you. I mean, it's also weird to respond to that as it's responsible for the
as far as the support is concerned, we are building the support and can imagine that we've grown all of a sudden by 1,300 to something up all by broadband. We've got to expand that significantly. So we've expanded the outfits for the IT service space that is specifically dedicated to students. We're still expanding on that. We're still working on a lot. Obviously, we've got a service improvement plan for that as well. And we do support all schools irrespective of what they are doing. Now, we also got to understand that there's a lot of stuff that is installed in schools and that was done outside of the Missouri project and the broadband project and all the other official projects, which we also support. So the number there is exorbitant. The help list has gone live, the new help list has gone live. We monitor it very carefully. We're trying to bring the gap between when a school reports something to when it's resolved very quick. A lot of the problems that we are getting is power related, particularly in the rural areas, and they're not experiencing some problems in that regard. And also the level of ICT literacy varies from school to school. So a lot of them require a lot more holding of their hands, and that's going to take 2 or 3 years, if not longer than that, and so forth and so on.
Could just ask one follow-up? I hear the help desk and I hear that basically having to expand that has, you know, taken on all these schools, but what some schools complain about is the fact that sometimes they need an actual visit. They need someone to literally come out that can't be handled over. Is there, like this help desk, what is the current staffing of the help desk and how many people, if any, are available to physically go to schools, or is that an outsourced function?
It's both. So with regards to the Lands and e-learning project, these are companies that assist us to do that support. But we've got our own staff, and we've got regional offices in Fremantle, in Worcester and George, that do that support. But obviously it's limited. We do not have a lot of people. Between those three regional offices, we've got about 27 people to cover a new geographical area. And sometimes we drive to the school, not sometimes we often. We've got to drive 300 to 500 kilometres. To get them to isolate what the problem is. So capacity is a bit of an issue at the moment.
So Chief, there are 27 officials in this territory for our purposes. There's 27 officials, is that in the non-metro areas where that the support staff that you have for CDI supporting schools? Is it 27? Is that the total?
There's 27. Plus we use some interns and a couple of others that we can get to.
Thank you very much.
I think it's important to say that we applied to the Jobs Fund for a major grant to help the school in that respect. So what we're looking at is, and we did have a successful application to the Jobs Fund, and now we're in the process of recruiting young people who are unemployed but who have the capacity quite quickly to train and bring up the basics of what can go wrong to a computer network in a school. And often, if they have a problem and they speak to somebody from the Centre for Innovation on the Health Care, they can often isolate the problem much more quickly than a teacher who maybe doesn't have that technical knowledge. So what we're trying to do is use young people who are often much more versed in this anyway, and train them up to help us at that level. Now, this is the first time that we're doing it on the scale, the first time we've really focused on this, and we're hoping it'll be a success. But the idea is, in many of our schools, to have one of these people who can go around and just check that all the basics, you know, someone hasn't pulled out the plug, which often happens, someone hasn't switched off the switch, which often happens, and all the basics like that, and then some minor technical stuff.
Thank you, gentlemen, for getting on broadband infrastructure. I ask questions without a function, and also I'll need to get some peace of mind out there. economic funds. In previous discussions on the South provisioning of broadband infrastructure, there has been mentioned that there were acts of criminality, the damaging vandalizing of broadband infrastructure, especially cabling and fiber, and providers paid protection money to criminals for protecting their stocks, etc. Could you first give an indication of what the status quo is at this present, or whether there's a decline in the South? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Perhaps I'll take the first half of it and ask you then to perhaps provide a bit more detail. I think the initial instances of criminality which impacted us quite severely was during the rollout phase. So it was literally at the point that the equipment on the team were having to trench into certain communities, and they were quite severely impacted by criminal operations in that area. We have worked quite closely with the Department of Community Safety, as well as the City of Canton, to try and remediate that. The issue has been less acute than the other days. I think we've had some good progress. Where there is a concern is that as we have now embarked on phase two of the project, which requires the migration of a lot of our technology from wireless to fiber, that does require the legal technology to go back into the communities to trench. And so we are mindful of that. It is something that we are working quite closely with the stakeholders in the city of Canton, but also with the legal technology. It's a particularly difficult issue because there have been times when I've got to thank the DG and the SG on our side for the interventions when we've had these issues. But it's particularly difficult for and that's really not the same thing, but every time I source a lot of work to local communities, that was a conditional contract. And you'd understand the difficulty of, as a member of the community, having to report on criminal activities in the area, I think that being concerns for us. Now, it's not that it's very difficult for us to act. If we aren't having an official task being opened as an example. So there have been some anomalies in that regard, but as I say, it's been executed in recent months. As we now get back to laying fiber and migrating to having to trench to lay the fiber, we anticipate some issues, but we are putting on smart fiber planning processes.
Thank you, Chair. So we just interrupt. The problems we have experienced relate to mainly the rollout of the broadband services. We have, however, at some of our sites, also there have been cases of theft and vandalism at some of the sites where people who go onto the premises of the school and steal some of the equipment that has already been installed with the service that has been delivered. That doesn't constitute a very big percentage of the sites that have been affected, but we have had such cases. I think Linda Mitchell and some of the committee members visited schools in the Oakland area last year. They had come across one such case where, when they got to the site, the service was not in operation as a result of theft that they can put at the school. So we have those cases as well, but it hasn't had such a big impact on the services, maybe, though, but they have in those cases.
Members, we move on to page 6 and 7.
Thank you. On page 7, I see a list of facts, rules, and regulations. I just want to check whether I'm not mistaken that there should be an addition of a language act, certificate language act, on the list of these regulations, and was supposed to help us to also be aware of the two major important languages in the city that is consistently being let's say, Africans and people close.
Thank you. And Jesus, that's on page 7, clearly the constitution of this province and the national constitution are applicable to the Department of the Premier. In fact, I think it could be argued that the Department of the Premier is the custodian of the provincial constitution. I think that's an issue that we've raised previously, and we've asked the Premier or the Department at NDG to give us clarity, number one, on what is their anticipated time frame for the actual appointment of the Children's Commission. We understand that the province has now finally accepted their responsibility, their obligation upon them to appoint the Children's Commissioner. We'd just like to ask, in this financial year in the discussion, are there any funds that have come from this department or they're coming from another department? But clearly this department is the one that is responsible for the setting up of the overseeing the setting up of the Children's Commission. Secondly, we've been asking questions about, similar questions about the Environmental Commissioner. We've never received any positive responses. And then recently, I think a couple of days ago, we've seen a gazette which indicates the intention to actually amend the constitution. Now, I think members of this committee would be aware that at least about 2.5 years ago, we had a consultation process throughout the province where, in all the public hearings, there was a clear rejection of the attempt to make the appointment of both of these commissioners discretionary. Yet we now see there's a bill coming which wants to amend the constitution, which effectively would do away with the issue of the environmental commissioner. Now, to amend the constitution is clearly a process that takes a long time. But as we speak, this province is actually in defiance of the provisions of the constitution, which require there to be both the children and the environmental commissioner. So could we just have, so my question about the children's commissioner is the time frame for the budget allocations in this financial year, particularly from the Department of the Premier, or the Premier is aware of that the planning will come from another department. And then secondly, I'd like to ask a direct question that, given that there's an obligation to appoint an environmental commissioner, will the province take steps to appoint the environmental commissioner, even though they have now initiated the process to actually remove, as far as I understand it, the provision to appoint a commissioner? My question is really, we are in defiance of the provisions of the constitution, so even though we're wanting to amend it, we want to know, are there any funds allocated for the setting up of the environmental commissioner? Could we have a situation where that constitutional amendment is rejected because you need 2/3 of this house? So while we're having this process, we don't see any steps to actually appoint the commissioner. So is there any intention to still carry on with setting up the environmental commission despite the fact that we now have a bill before that has been tabled?
Given that maybe just to say, he's quite correct. The Children's Commissioner, that was published for comment. We received quite a lot of comments from at least 24 organisations. That is currently being incorporated, so the bill is being revised, and that is likely to be introduced in the Provincial Parliament during the second quarter of this calendar year, in other words, the first quarter of the new financial year. Obviously, the appointment of the Commissioner can only ensue once that bill has been enacted. That process will be obviously under the control in the under remit of the Provincial Parliament. I can't answer exactly on whether the funds will be inappropriate for this year. I think that's not what I need to go there. As far as the Environmental Commissioner is concerned, there was a submission to the Provincial Cabinet, and the policy position that was assumed is that based on legal advice that was received and also input from the Department of Environmental Affairs and Development Planning, it is not worth investing in the establishment of an environmental commissioner. It is believed from a policy position that there are sufficient safeguards in the very, very many national pieces of legislation that deal with the environment. But obviously that bill, as you correctly remarked, Member Dougmore, was published this week only for public comment. So there has to be a public participation process. And I think it's important to point out that that is not a tick box exercise. The policy position has been assumed, and yes, it may be the same as it was 2.5 years ago, but there has to be a public participation process, and obviously depending on what comes out of that, both in terms of the executive's own public participation process and should the bill be tabled in the House, the public participation process that will be followed by the Provincial Parliament, that will actually determine whether the commissioner is established or whether the provincial constitution is ultimately amended. So that process must follow its course. And obviously the policy position around the appointment of the commissioner is something that needs to be deliberated on and interrogated as part of the provincial parliament's duty when that bill is tabled in the House.
I would like to ask a long interpretation. We have a constitution, and then you refer to a policy position. Now what comes what here? Because there's a constitution, so even if the province has another policy position, there's an obligation to have, in terms of the supreme law, this province, as affirmed by the constitutional court, that the provincial constitution is law, and there's an obligation. So surely a provincial policy position does not negate the need for the province to comply with the constitution and actually appoint that commission. If, for instance, you then go through the process and you amend the constitution, that could, if you have a commission established, lead to the disbanding of it. But surely a policy position doesn't trump the provisions of the constitution.
Thank you for that follow-up question. Maybe, I do agree, I've said it before, there's been a 20-year-old failure to comply with the constitution around the establishment of the environmental commission. That is not in dispute, and it's not something that I would deny. But there's also, one also must be alive to the fact that, if we take, for example, the POPI legislation, protection of personal information, it hasn't been enacted yet. But, we are now not going to introduce programs and make information available that would go against the spirit of something that inevitably will be enacted. Now, obviously, with the Environmental Commissioner, as I said, the executive retains an open mind, there's a public participation process, but does it really make sense to appoint a commissioner in circumstances where there's at least a prospect that the commissioner will ultimately not be appointed? Or that the obligation that's currently legally, as you pointed out, that does exist, that obligation will fall away. Bearing in mind that the establishment of such an office would involve the establishment not only of a commissioner, but support staff, you have to provide office space, so you might incur a lot of expenses that if that bill is eventually tabled and provides for the removal of those provisions claims to the commission, and if that bill is enacted, then you've established a whole office and that could really be wasted. So I'm just saying it would be against the spirit of what the cabinet at the moment has in mind, but obviously subject to the public participation process.
Thank you very much. And then as we move on to page.
sorry, if that has been excluded, we will definitely make sure. We do review the list from time to time, but you know, there are so many laws that sometimes something does slip between the cracks, but we will just certainly review the entire list just to make sure it gets up there.
And just we move on to page 8 and 9, 10 and 11.
Page 10, under demands and changes of service, the first two paragraphs there that speaks about service delivery, environmental compliance, people management, customized by the dependent relationship between the people manager in the state of department and people professional in the branch. Now, my question is this not the certification that we awarded previously? And then, the second paragraph also speaks about the Western Cape operation in Korean sites and challenges, and on that management impact severely. So my question is, what is significant prison and why is it severely?
Thank you very much. Thank you, members. Yes, with regard to your first question, member, the distinction is made between a people professional and a people manager. In this case, a people professional is the expert, the HR expert that resides within my branch, and the people manager is your line manager. So there's no duplication, because within the performance of a function, let's say, for example, recruitment, everybody has a role to play, a team role to play. For example, we assist with the recruitment process, but ultimately, for example, it's the HOD or the delegated authority in that department that actually makes the appointment. So there is no duplication, just a clarity of the role of the different people who play in there. And then secondly, the second paragraph really just deals with the challenges which are placed on us by the sphere environment. It means that we are not necessarily as responsive as we need to be. So for example, instead of taking 2 or 3 days to respond to a query, or taking to the longer because the work the increases. So it's really dealing with just the impact of all the challenges facing responding to demands. Because as you know, notwithstanding the fact that we have personnel cut and we cannot always work on our posts, but on the other side, our client departments are still expecting a particular level of service from us, and it's that tension that we're trying to set up in terms of this demands.
Thank you very much.
Members
of the
Institute
of
Admission,
Member
Mugato, Member Chibuya. Yes, on the same page, I think I the sentence on the same demands and changes in services. I think it's paragraph 4. The last sentence there saying the structure of the branch would have to be reviewed in order to formalize the engineering and the administration and to a more permanent solution. The more clear the Russian Commission should have projected with regard to I just need more clarity on this. Secondly, over page 11, there is a first problem. A growing demand of legal services coupled with capacity constraints can cause delay in service delivery as large blah blah blah. But my question, can you be explained what are these lists of services, of legal services? Can you be given perhaps as a list of those legal services so that we can understand what are the issues and also be explained that members of the directive can just do so that we can understand what is impact on the
by Medicaid and so on. Unit to assist with SMS methods and also with performance management issues.
after a couple of years, there's still no proven need for it. They've shown what they need to do in that state, and we're now converting into an organizational structure. So I mean, what is that? I mean, that process has actually now really concluded. It's gone to the unions, and they've now signed up on that process.
Yes, I think just very briefly to answer the question, particularly on the lead service delivery. I think it's one of our main services, which I'll just very quickly refer to. It's basically providing legal opinions. And essentially what that means is if the department wants to know, for example, can we do something from a legal perspective, until such time as we go back to them, they won't do anything. So that's why we then delay that project or initiative. We've seen a particular growth in the contracting environment. In fact, we now open close to 1,000 files per annum just based on the drafting and for the drafting and scrutiny of the contract. And obviously, to use one example, if there's, for example, a human settlement development where a contract needs to be concluded, the longer we take to draft it or to get it, the longer it takes for the department to actually roll out the project. Litigation, nobody likes litigation because what it does is essentially suspends decisions and actions by government. So whilst something is under review by the court, obviously the department can't move forward and you have to have an outcome either that your decision is invalid and you have to take a new decision or your decision is valid and you can actually proceed with it. And then obviously legislation is key. I mean, this is the government is regulated. We regulate ourselves. And that is key to service delivery. So if a department or a member of the executive wants to introduce a new law in order to improve service delivery, the longer we take to draft that law, the longer it takes to improve service delivery. So just to give you an idea of some of the services and why we say that there is a direct impact on service delivery.
Thank you.
Members,
I think follow up on this.
On the line piece, there was an initiative by national government that executed through the provincial department of cultural affairs and sport under which the provincial library service resides to assist the libraries, particularly in the rural areas, to be connected to the network and to the internet as a rich source of information for the citizens in those areas. So CI has been assisting them with the project for the past couple of years, and it is focused on primarily the rural libraries because that's where the need was. So that continues. When Rolf came with the broadband project, it gave us the opportunity to connect those libraries at much higher speeds than what we could before. And that was the advantage.